Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Laura McManus. She's just written a book called It's Not About the Pom-Poms, How a 40-Year-Old Mom Became the NFL's Oldest Cheerleader and Found Hope, Joy, and Inspiration Along the Way. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And you're joining us by telephone from right here in the Dayton area. You grew up in the Dayton area, didn't you?
I did. My whole entire family did.
And you're back here. You've traveled a little bit. Didn't you live in Atlanta for a while and Austin?
I did, and I went to college in Los Angeles.
So you wrote a book. What made you do it?
Well, after I graduated college, I was married, and I was married for a very long time, and during the 16 years I was married, it turned into just a slow degradation of my confidence. He was extremely verbally abusive, occasionally physical, and it really broke me down. And I just didn't realize with the verbal going on that how slowly it kind of creeps up on you and what it does to your psyche and how my confidence was so low. I was completely depressed, and somehow I managed to have two children during that time, but I really kind of was like, I am so not happy. I'm not a good mom. I have a lot of anger. This is just not working for me. So once I got out of the marriage, I had a conversation with myself, and I said, what is going to make you happy? And it was dancing. So once I figured that out, I started taking some dance lessons, and then I went to a couple Bengals games, and I saw the girls on the field. And I said, you know what? They are so confident. They're dancing. I love dancing. They look great. They're having so much fun. I want to gain that confidence just like they do. And so in one of my dance classes, ironically, I ran into a Bengal who was an ex-Bengal cheerleader. And she said, you know what? I think you should try out. And I kind of giggled and I said, you don't know how old I am. She said, you know what? It doesn't matter. I really think they would love you. I think you should try out. And it just kind of went from there.
This marriage that you had that caused you so much pain and was so damaging. You had some warnings, didn't you, before you went into it. This is a fellow that you met in the Dayton area. You were still going to school out in California. And in the book, you write that you were addicted to being loved.
Exactly. You know, every little girl has those dreams of going to college and then marrying their, you know, man of their dreams and having children in this wonderful house. And I think I was so caught up in that little dream, and I was so young. I was only 22 when I got married, that it was all about the big wedding, and I really didn't. We did long distance for about 9 months, and then when I finally moved back to Dayton, there was very intense physical things that were going on that were warning signs, and I just kind of wrote them off. I was like, no, I have this whole wedding plan. I don't want to, you know, stop it, and there's all these people coming, and I just kind of got so caught up in it that I didn't focus on the relationship, and I really should have had more sense and respect for myself to say, you know what, I am not doing this. We need to wait. We need to work this out, and I just didn't do it, and I could kick myself for it.
He was really jealous, wasn't he?
Yeah, and what's funny is once I kind of laid it on the line and said, you know, don't touch me again, that's where it turned verbal. And what's really interesting about verbal abuse is that it just starts, you know, really minor, so you don't really realize it's going on. But those little voices start creeping in your head all the time, and then you're the one who's insecure, and you start believing all this stuff. And then there's more anger, and there's more, you feel insecure, and so you start acting differently. And because you're acting differently, there's more verbal abuse. So it just kind of goes in this cycle. And, you know, of course, if it's really bad, they'll apologize and be very, very nice, and you get caught up in, oh, you know what, maybe they won't do it again. But then it just starts happening again, and the cycle just continues, and you just don't realize how it affects you and how broken and depressed you end up being. And that's what happened to me.
And it's a vicious cycle that's really hard to break free from. And
right.
You talk about your family growing up, and do you think maybe the relationship between your own parents might have had a profound effect upon your relationship with your husband?
Oh, absolutely. My dad was definitely not quite as bad as my ex-spouse was, but with my mom, it was definitely, you know, a controlling type person. So I definitely think it had an effect because that was something I was a little bit used to. But it's funny when I talk to girlfriends and they've been married for a while, and they would say to me, my husband has never called me that name before. And it's like, really? Like, that's not normal? And you start realizing that, wow, stuff that is normal in your family or normal in your current family with your spouse is really not normal, and it can do some really bad damage to you. And once you start recognizing that, that's when you start getting a little spark of, I really need to start taking care of myself and doing what's good for me and stop believing what he's telling me.
My guest is Laura McManus. Her book is It's Not About the Pom-Poms. When your parents got divorced, your dad really kind of fell out of your life. You saw him a little bit, but not too much. And you make the statement in the book that you felt desperate for male love.
Yeah, I was told by a therapist that was kind of surprising to me at the time that I was abandoned. And I just kind of looked at her and was like, what are you talking about? And he didn't abandon us. And she's like, yes, he did. He left and you didn't see him. He didn't really make that much of an effort to see you as you got older. Didn't seem as interested. And then I started realizing that, yeah, that's why I cling on to these men that aren't necessarily good for me and I can't let go. And that's where it's just you get into this habit of trying to desperately find something and searching for something that may not be good for you. But when you finally recognize it, you can really make better choices and realize that even though I am gravitated towards a certain type of individual, maybe I should choose something different that's going to be better for me in the long run.
We were chatting before we went on the air, and you mentioned a movie deal, and it made me wonder, since you said that that happened a while ago, that you had this conversation about the film deal. Which came first, the book or the movie?
The movie actually did. They heard my story on Yahoo.com, and they started calling, and a deal was made. And so when I flew out to New York City to talk about the movie deal, I actually met with, you have to have an agent to write a contract. So I ended up meeting my agent in person, and he suggested that I hook up with this co-author who could help me write my story because it would make a great book. So while I was out there, we shopped some publishers, and someone picked it up the very next day, which was great.
You've co-written it with Amy Sohn. What was the process? How did you two collaborate on this project?
It was so fabulous. She's such a fabulous person, and it almost felt like a year-long worth of therapy because I would tell her and nonstop talk about all these stories. She would come out and visit me in Dayton for weeks at a time, or we'd talk on the phone every day, and I would tell her these stories and different things that would happen, and she was so good at figuring out the whys and the insight, and it just really helped me, and it was great. She's a great writer. I would talk and talk and talk, and she would write, and I would edit, and we'd go back, and I'd say, well, I really didn't mean it like that, and this is what I really meant, and so it was a lot of going back and forth, and what is written in the book is truly my words, but she definitely helped a little bit to draw it out of me a little better than I think I could have done it myself.
As I was reading the book, I had a few flashbacks to things I'd forgotten about, and you talk about how you became so interested in exercising and how exercising kind of became a way for you to escape from the reality of the marriage that you were in. And you mentioned a show that I'd completely forgotten about called The 20-Minute Workout.
Yes.
I totally forgot about that show. That was quite popular, I can recall.
It was. I loved it. And it's just one of those things where I just wanted to – I felt very much in control of my body and my situation through exercise. And what's really funny is it's just ironic that exercise produces those good hormones that make you feel good. And all of a sudden, when you feel good, you start choosing your food better and you start taking care of yourself better. So it's kind of like what comes first, the chicken or the egg. And I feel like if you're not feeling good about yourself, just go outside for a walk or go for a bike ride or just get some exercise, because the more you start doing that, the more those hormones start going around, and then it's just a great momentum to start taking care of yourself again.
And I would guess that you're quite an authority on good diet because, well, tell us about your day job.
I am a registered dietitian, and I run a weight loss program. And I used to work at Miami Valley Hospital here in Dayton on the cardiovascular floor, which I liked, and I counseled patients on their diet and how to reduce their heart attack risk. But I then got asked by a family physician to run a weight loss program in his office, and I obviously have struggled with my weight for years and could draw upon my own resources and what I've done to keep myself in check, especially with the emotional issues that I've dealt with. And what's kind of evolved is that I kind of feel more like a counselor than a dietitian sometimes, because I think what really stands out, because I've been doing this now for probably 6 or 7 years, is that behavior more than anything is usually the number one problem when it comes to weight. And people aren't aware of it, but like stress eating and emotional eating, it's all tied into food. And if you can try to get your emotions under control and at least be aware of what you're doing with food and how you're, quote, using food, then usually you can get a handle on what's going on. And it's funny because we start out with just diet, but then when the emotional issues are kind of uncovered a little bit and they realize them, then they get even better control and it becomes more of a long-term weight loss, which is good.
And this is such a touchy topic. You talk in the book about how your father said something very insulting to your mother about her weight.
And that's one of those things where he said something to me, too. He hadn't seen me in a while, and I got in the car, and he's like, wow, you've put on some weight. And I think I was 13 at the time, and it affected me so much. And that's when I was like, wow, I think I have gained weight, and I started reading fitness magazines, and that's how I ended up being interested in becoming a dietitian, one of the reasons why. And it's just so, I have two daughters. They're 13 and 15, and that's kind of a very touchy age where you don't want to focus too much on your weight. You want them to just, you know, choose wisely and pay attention to when they're full and their food choices and their exercise. But you also don't want them to get too caught up in looking at the scale and what they look like all the time, too. So it's just a very, very touchy situation.
Well, we are a culture that's obsessed with image. And
right.
You probably know that better than any of us.
Right.
Being a cheerleader in the National Football League, you talk about this whole experience. We get a real in-depth visitation into the whole phenomenon that you experience becoming a Bengal, and you're going to be one again this season, aren't you?
I would hope so. I try out in a couple months. So
okay,
it's
not for sure yet.
No, we have to try out every year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, so once again, you go through the same nerve-wracking process.
Yes. It's always a challenge, but I think it's good for us because it keeps our own self in check, and it also keeps the talent that comes in on the team at the highest it can be, which is nice.
Well, the first time you tried out, you didn't make it, did you?
I did not make it, and, you know, it was a personal journey to even put myself in the stadium and wear that tiny little outfit. I needed a lot of confidence to do that, and it definitely grew as I started dancing and started getting involved with the program and then trying out and not making it. But when I didn't make it, it was such a rejection. I kind of crumbled for a couple hours and went back to my old self of no confidence. But then I was like, you know what? I'm so much further along than I was a couple years ago. I feel better about myself. I have more confidence. I don't feel depressed as much. And not to mention, the organization is so great at giving back with the community, and all the girls, we have so much in common that I really want to train a little bit harder, and I want to know exactly what to do to get on the team, because I want to do it again next year, and I did.
Laura McManus joins us. Her book is It's Not About the Pom-Poms, How a 40-Year-Old Mom Became the NFL's Oldest Cheerleader. She joins us on the telephone from somewhere in the greater Dayton area because she still lives in our community. And she grew up here. What was your old neighborhood growing up?
I grew up initially on Berry Creek in Kettering. And it was just, you know, kind of one of those leave it to beaver type neighborhoods. It was just, you know, parades down the street and lots of parties outside and grilling out. It was just really fun. And then we moved away to Michigan. It was kind of more of the same. And then when I came back, my parents had divorced and my mom came back as a single parent. So when she came back, we were in a nice neighborhood for sure, still in Kettering. But it was a little different because it was just us three girls, my mom and my sister and me. So we just kind of were very independent and a little free. She let us have our freedom a little bit, but we were independent, and it kind of made me realize that how hard my mom works and that we also need to kind of pull some of the weight with the household.
I understand that you've been flying to New York a bit here the last couple of weeks. Has this been for publicity for the book?
Yes.
What kind of stuff have you been doing?
Oh, let's see. I was on The Revolution, on ABC The Revolution. I was on NBC's Today Show, Fox and Friends. I did a radio tour all around the country. is so many different things. AOL shot a video that will be coming up pretty soon. It has been just phenomenal.
Gee whiz.
I know. It's been a lot.
What do your daughters think about all this?
Oh, my gosh. Well, at first when I told them I was trying out 3 years ago, they were like, Mom, what are you doing? Because they're cheerleaders as well. However, they're in the competition cheerleading. And the first thing they asked me was, Mom, what are you doing? You can't do back handsprings. But I told her, no. It's all dancing. It's a lot of fun. And now that they see how hard I work and they see me down in the field when they attend the games, they just are so proud. And they realize that I'm working so hard and sometimes a little harder than the other girls because I'm my age. I have to work a little harder for my body to respond. But they really appreciate it, and they're just so proud. They just think it's great.
So what's your typical day like when you're getting ready for the tryout? What does your schedule look like? Is there just constant workout going on? Or what?
Pretty much. I pretty much keep it up through the year. However, I wake up usually at 5 in the morning, and I go for a run, or I go to the gym and lift weights. Usually it's a half an hour to 45 minutes. And then I get ready for work. I send the kids off to school. I go to work. I come home during practice time or tryouts. Then I have to, as soon as I get home, I coordinate the schedules with the girls, get them to where they need to be. We have to be in full hair and makeup before we go to practice. So I have to spend a little time getting that ready. I get my pom-poms and my shoes and everything ready to go, the outfit, the pantyhose, the bra top, all that. And then I drive 45 minutes to the stadium. If you're already on the team, we get weighed in. We eat dinner. We practice for 2.5 to 3 hours. And then I drive home. And then I put the kids in bed. So it's just like a whole little coordination. We usually practice 2 to 3 days a week. Usually it's 2. But during tryouts, I definitely keep up 3 days a week running, 3 days a week weight training, and then I really try and watch my food intake. I definitely eat whatever I want, but I don't eat as much as I want.
Well, this is clearly a labor of love for you because, as we discover after reading your book, you don't get rich doing what you're doing as a Bengal, do you?
No, a lot of people think it's our full-time job, and it's quite the opposite because we need to have a full-time job or be a full-time student before we can even apply to be a Bengal. And then when you do go through all the 2 months of tryouts and finally get on the team and a summer long of 3 to 4 days a week of working out to learn all the dances and practices, when we finally make it to our first game, there's 32 of us, but only 24 of us cheer. And of the 24, those are the only girls who get the $75 a game. The other girls who don't put their boots on the field, they don't get paid. So we only get $75 a game. And so it's definitely a competition to get on the field, and it's hard.
When you were in, I believe, high school, you took some sort of an aptitude test that tried to identify what career might be good for you. And at the time, you were kind of upset because it said that a career in the military was probably the best option for you, and your classmates were being told they should be doctors or lawyers or whatever. And you didn't really get it for a long time until you became an NFL cheerleader. You just made the comment, put our boots on the field. This is the military prediction, isn't it?
Isn't it? It's so true. Isn't that odd? Yes. And also, too, it's interesting because with being a Bengal, there comes a lot of responsibility and a lot of rules, and I find that I'm really good at someone telling me what to do. In my marriage, it didn't work out too well that way, but as far as my job and just as a dietitian, or even just a project I need to work on, you know, I can brainstorm a little bit, but I'm really good with, you just do this and then go and execute it. I'm really good at doing that, and that's kind of how the Bengals are. Show us the dance, and then you go out on the field and execute it. And like I said, there's other rules as well, but it is kind of like the military, so it's worked out well.
You just barely made it for that first game, didn't you?
Oh, yes. My very first game, I live 45 minutes from the stadium. I accidentally left my uniform at home, and I drove halfway to the stadium in rush hour traffic because it happened to be a night game during the week. So this was not a Sunday game. And as soon as I realized it, I rushed back to the house. And if you don't make it to the TV station where we get a carpool over to the stadium, if you don't make it there on time, you will not cheer. So So I rushed back home to get my uniform, and I literally drove 100 miles an hour. I'm not even exaggerating. In and out of traffic to get to the stadium, and I did not make it to the TV station where I was supposed to be on time. However, all the girls rallied around, and we kind of snuck a little parking pass out from a different car, and they ended up getting me to the stadium where I ultimately needed to be on time. And as soon as I got in the line, the coaches turned around, and they didn't even know otherwise that I was rushing to get there. And there I was in line, just right where I should be. But it was really a testament to the sisterhood and how we all rally around to help each other when we need to.
Laura McManus joins us on the program today. Her memoir is called It's Not About the Pom-Poms, How a 40-Year-Old Mom Became the NFL's Oldest Cheerleader and Found Hope, Joy, and Inspiration Along the Way. I think somewhere in the book you make the statement that you wanted to be adored. Is that correct?
You know what? I think everybody in some way wants to be adored. And I definitely, you know, like with my parents being divorced, my mom definitely adores me. But my dad wasn't around, so I definitely was seeking male adoration. And then in my marriage, he definitely didn't adore me. If he said he did, it didn't come out in his actions at all or his verbiage to me. So I think that I felt like for dancing for me and performing when I was little, that's where I really found being on the stage, you know, doing recitals when I was only 8 and 9 years old. That really is where I found my home. So as an adult, unless you're doing, like, things you probably shouldn't be doing at strip clubs, there's no real big stages unless you're on Broadway or a strip club for adults. So for me, when I was dancing, I did go back to adult dance classes, but there's no recitals for that. And so when the girl said, I think you should try out for being a Bengal, I thought to myself, you know what? That's kind of like a stage. And I think I want to try out, and I think I'll really feel at home there. And so once we had the first game and I walked out there in front of 60,000 people with my uniform on, I felt exactly like I did when I was 8 and 9 years old of, this is just really fun. I love performing, and it's fun.
Well, you're probably getting way more adoration than you ever wanted at that point. You describe a very funny situation where you wanted to learn how to do pole dancing, and you went down to Cincinnati, and you were trying to find the studio. And this is a really funny story.
It is so funny. Yes, I Googled on the internet adult dance classes. And when you put on the internet adult dance classes, it comes up with very interesting things. And the first thing that came up in the Dayton and Cincinnati area was pole kittens. And I kind of like looked over my shoulder. Is anybody watching me on my computer? Because it says pole dancing. So I felt a little weird to look at it. But I was like, you know what? Let me check it out. I've kind of heard and read in magazines that pole dancing is the latest and greatest craze in fitness. And I've always been interested in fitness. So I went ahead and clicked on it. And it just talked about how the classes are really small and they focus in on gaining women's self-esteem back. And it's all about the exercise. They're not training you to be strippers or anything. So I decided to go ahead and venture down to Cincinnati to go and find it. Well, it's down on Vine Street, which is kind of in a little bit of an area where you probably shouldn't be at night sometimes as a woman.
Over the Rhine.
Mm-hmm. So I went there, and it just happened to be at the top of a tattoo parlor. So I wasn't quite sure I was in the right place. So when I went in and I knocked on the door, there was a gentleman there putting a tattoo on someone, and he was all tatted up himself and piercings, and there was incense. And I was just like, am I in the right place? And I just told myself, come on, just go in, just do it, you can do it. So I went in and asked him, you know, is there pole kittens? And so he's like, yeah, it's upstairs. And so as I'm winding up all these staircases up to the third floor in this little tiny tattoo parlor, I started like getting a panic attack almost, where I was like, no one knows I'm here. I didn't tell anybody I was going pole dancing, and I don't even know where I'm going. It's upstairs. Like, this could be really, really bad for me. But I finally got up there, and there were these little tank tops with rhinestones that said pole kittens, and I walked in the room, and it was very feminine and purple walls and shiny mirrors and the shiny poles. And I said, you know what? This is going to be really fun. Just open yourself up to something new and just see how it goes. And it was. It was really fun, and it was really hard. And over the course of a couple months, I gained some really nice biceps.
Speaking of gaining physical attributes, there are some things that you wanted to change about your own physique, and you have had some surgery. Has your life improved as a result of the surgery?
Absolutely. I got breast implants, and I think a lot of people think it's because I wanted to be a cheerleader, and every cheerleader needs nice breasts, but that's absolutely not the case. My sister is naturally a size F, and so I've kind of always had like a boob complex, and my breasts never grew, and I kind of took on my dad's side of the family where we're all pretty much flat-chested. And that was part of my gaining my confidence back. I was so overly obsessed with how small I was in the breast area that I felt like I really needed to have it done. And once I did, and this was before Bengals, I just felt fantastic instantly. I mean, as soon as the bandages came off the next day, I was like, I feel fantastic. So I kind of just fulfilled the need, and I don't even think about them anymore. It was just something that I needed for myself. I mean, it helps when you're in a uniform and you don't have to wear a push-up bra, but it's one of those things where we have a lot of girls on the squad who don't have a large chest, and it's okay. The Bengals thankfully look for a lot of different body types, and we rejoice that, and it's fine. So I really just did it for me and my own confidence.
You got a really great blurb for your book from a writer who I admire. Julie Clam wrote, "Laura McManus's story is engaging and wildly empowering. It's not about the pom-poms, gives new meaning to the term second act. It makes you want to get up off your couch and go fight, win."
Yes.
And Julie is a real dog lover, and you have a dog that you talk about in the book quite a bit that apparently gave you a lot of comfort. Is your dog still around?
Yes, it's Penny. She's a little chihuahua. She weighs about 9 pounds. She's been wonderful. She's just always happy and bouncy, and every time I come in the door, her tail's wagging, and she loves to snuggle like a little kitty cat. So she's just always around, and she's great. Yeah, she's perfect.
Well, Laura, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
The book is It's Not About the Pom-Poms, How a 40-Year-Old Mom Became the NFL's Oldest Cheerleader and Found Hope, Joy, and inspiration along the way, and they might be making a movie about Laura's life as well. And Laura, good luck with the tryouts.
Thank you so much. Hopefully you'll see me on the field in the fall.
Well, if you're on TV, we probably will.
I hope so.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Laura, I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did.
Yes, that was perfect. Thank you so much. You're such a great interviewer. I've done so many radio shows. You are by far the best one. Thank you so much.
Oh, you
definitely
probably
did your homework.
You probably say that to all of them.
No, I'm not even kidding you. Like, you asked some really good questions. Other people are just all about, like, real superficial things. But, no, you really read the book and did a great job interviewing. Thank you.
Well, you know what really helps, Laura?
What's that?
Reading the book.
I know. I don't think a lot of people really do.
Yeah.
So thank you. I appreciate
it.
Well,
you have fun with it, okay?
Thank you. I have
You
been.
Take
thank
care. You. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Next week on the program, we'll be joined by a crime novelist from Iceland with a very unusual book. It's called Ashes to Dust. Tune in next week for an interview with Yrsa Sigurðardóttir, right here in The Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.